Andy, good morning.
I have a question. What do you
Yeah.
think the over-under is on the number of listeners that were interested and really wanted to know what was going on with Callio?
Well,
No, I'm
you'd
just, I want a number because I have
be
one in mind. I'm thinking 3.5 is the over-under. What do you think?
Well,
And
Saul
I'm
was
being
probably
optimistic.
interested.
You actually have to lay a price. You get a price to go over.
I think
How
I'm
many
going to.
people, when you hung up on Brendan, said, "I can't believe Steve forgot to ask him about Callio"? That number's even lower than 3.5.
Well, I also forgot to ask Mike about win-win-win, about when he's going to
Oh,
rejoin.
that must have been a heartbreaker. Has he run since he ran in that race he shouldn't have been in?
Well, he did. He won that turf stake.
Yeah, I understand. There are races that you shouldn't run in, and it's worse when you win them. That would be one of them. Has he run since that race?
No, he's been out. He's been on the farm. But I will get an update though, because I know there's at least one person because we got the request on Twitter.
I'm sure he would have had no shot in the King's Bishop or the Alan Jerkins the way it was run. I'm sure it just never would have worked out the way it was run, because how could he have beaten Chancellor? Oh, that's right. Chancellor didn't win. Anyhow, so much time, Steve, so little to talk about.
That's not true. It's the other way around. It's the flip side.
What do you want to do? You want to talk about Pause the Cause not winning the La Verdad this weekend?
You could talk about that, and boy, how
I
about?
wasn't really planning on it, but
No, I know, but it does give opportunity to mention Mike Maselli, who picks up where he left off. He got the win, right, in that race?
no, Mark Kenny won that race.
No, no. I guess it was the was it the Bay?
It
Must
was
have
a
been
while ago, the Mrs.
the
Warm
Bay
won.
Ridge. The Bay Ridge. I'm thinking of. Yeah.
The prestigious Bay Ridge.
My father's from Bay Ridge.
I didn't criticize the area Bay Ridge. I was mocking the race, not the location.
Well,
I want to be clear on that.
you could talk about Cash Offer's win. Hennig's busy down in Florida. All I see is Florida sunsets and sunrises from
Yeah, I
him.
know. She's awful. Well, she got better when she rated, right? She's now she couldn't win, couldn't win, couldn't win, and then 2 times in a row they rated her and she won both. Obviously, Pause the Cause didn't win, didn't run. I mean, I don't think it was the distance, and she's handled wet tracks before, so. But you know, she didn't break, but she ran up the lead pretty easily, and just you could see top of the stretch she had nothing. And Cash Offer ended up seeing a perfect trip, but it shows when a horse actually has the ability to rate and win, how well they can run, I guess.
Well, among the stakes during the holiday season, and the La Verdad, the last of the New Year's week action, but the Alex Robb, we should mention, Mr. Buff, just you got to admire Mr. Buff. He's got a lot of
He's
fans.
a cool horse, I agree.
Yeah.
Hopefully John won't ship him to any stakes out of town. You know, I understand taking a shot in the Woodward, but hopefully after the last two debacles this year, he'll just leave him here and try races here. But he's really a neat horse, I agree. You know, he seems to consistently run well. He is good. In events all, he's okay. I have a question for you. Did you look at his Thoroughgraph number? Somebody told me he ran the same rag number he ran in the National. Is that possible? Somebody smart told me that, so I don't have any reason to doubt it.
I have not
Ask
seen a
Jerry.
fig discussed. We can ask Jerry. I mean,
Well, he'll be on for this show for his weekly segment, right?
Jerry is it's funny. Jerry is as outgoing as he is in person. He's media shy.
Well, he's afraid you're going to take advantage of
I who could take advantage of Jerry?
him. Probably true. I'm just curious. I mean, it was hard to. Obviously, it wasn't that quick a race. I don't. You know, I didn't. You know, after he ran the Nashua, obviously there's an expectation that he could be, you know, a very good horse, and sort of anything short of a sort of, you know, huge performance, I think a lot of people were prone to be disappointed. I wasn't disappointed. I would be more, I'd be more concerned with his general behavior. I'd be more concerned with him, you know, acting up for 10 minutes in the paddock and then getting left. I think those are the things that Mike, I'm sure he discussed it with you, would have to be thinking about dealing with. I think he's a very good horse. I don't really think there's any great impetus for him to, you know, make his three-year-old debut and run some huge figure. Obviously, there's a reason they call them preps. I saw he said he was taking him down to Tampa to try, you know, Sam yeah. Davis next. Listen, I'm a fan of that horse. I like fast horses, and he ran very well in Nashua. I think that you do need to see him improve, I would think, off of his win at Jerome before you start feeling like he's a horse to win the Derby. But based on what I saw last year, he has a chance to be every bit as good, if not better, than every horse I saw run. I still think that Dennis's moment is probably the other best two-year-old I saw last year. You know, for him to have done what he did in just his third career start, second one with a jockey, and Breeders' Cup was obviously a throwout on the day where you could make throwouts. So he strikes me as a horse that I'm probably more confident will go longer than a Tis the Law. I like Tis the Law, but we'll see how far he ultimately wants to go, or how quickly he wants to go far. But in advance, all good.
Well, and we focused on Independence Hall, obviously, with Mike, and I really didn't get a chance to mention they had the two New York Breds dead heat for second behind him.
They were the second and third choices, and everybody else saw just one. So I don't think it was a particularly compelling story that the two second and third choices hit the wire together.
Well, it's more, you know, open company stake placements, state breads is nice.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think that Linda's horse ran okay, considering he had broken his maiden riding a gold rail. And Mark's horses, well, the thing that would have been most encouraging for Mark with his horse is he didn't get left for the first time in his third start. Now, he's all right, Mark's horse. You know, I don't think either one of them should have illusions of grandeur with their horses as far as major three-year-old preps, but they're okay, especially this early in their careers.
A couple of other three-year-olds, Andy, to ask about that, you know, people may have slipped under the radar, and that includes that tappet of Pletcher's that won at the short price by a dozen Portos the other day, going back to New Year's Eve.
That wasn't a competitive race.
No, but I mean, is this a...
A mile and eighth race in the beginning of January and it won the five shot.
I understand, but is it a horse? I mean, the way he did it, I mean, he earned a respectable fig.
He won like a 1-5 shot should. What kind of figure did he get?
84.
Okay. I don't know. No. I'm not... I don't have an opinion, positive or negative. Why should I?
No, I'm just curious.
Are they paying off on having opinions on maiden breakers?
Well, later on, they might. In a way, they do. Yes. How about
they're not paying off a week after the race? I don't. You're talking to the wrong guy. Nothing, not right or wrong. I'm just the wrong guy. I'm still laughing about Maxfield being one of the top three for the Eclipse Award.
Well, we'll get to that.
I don't want to offend Brendan, who was your last guest. He's a good trainer, and I wish him well with the horse, but how he's one of the top three three-year-olds. Listen, I saw some ridiculous ballot that had him listed as the number one, which is not, it's ridiculous. It's absurd.
I was surprised. He was surprised. I mean, he thought that he deserved some consideration, but he said when he got the call, he was mildly surprised that he ended up a finalist. A couple of other maiden wins, and then I will ask you. I want to talk to you about. We can fold in, some of the results from around the country as part of the discussion of Eclipse Awards. But High Amplitude, is there that maiden breaker last week as well?
He did it in a sloppy sealed track.
Yeah.
So, you have to. I think there was another big performance in that. Oh yeah, Alessio for Karen, yes. I guess she's a 4-year-old filly now. She got 100 buyer. Yeah, I mean, I Am Blue looked good, and you know, he was a horse that had some promise in the Triple Crown Trail last year. But you know, once again, I don't want to, you know, personal feelings aside, I don't want to get overly excited by a horse that's impressive breaking his maiden off a long layoff on a super sloppy track. We'll see what he does next time. He has the potential to be good. He had the potential to be good last year before he went out of the shelf, right?
Yeah, yeah, and Chad's good with this type.
What's that?
He's good with this type too. I mean, there's been a parade of these,
and they have to do it on a fast track, and they have to run other fast races. But he's promising. I mean, whether or not he turns out to be good remains to be seen. You couldn't have asked for a better return. You know, just like the Pletcher horse that you just mentioned, you couldn't ask him to have done more. But whether or not it ends up being particularly relevant going forward, well, it's hard to tell. It's hard to tell with sloppy track blowout wins, right? He was more professional. You know, he had speed, high amplitude, and he hadn't had speed in the past, right? So I think that was probably the more promising part. We'll see. I mean, he looked good, but I don't know.
You mentioned something that I want to bring up, a race from Sunday. That pricey allowance where Heiko.
Oh, the race they should have taken down the winner.
Yes, yes. Love Rock, Lone Rock.
Well, I mean,
left
to be
up.
Fair, the stewards don't believe that herding matters. They don't. They just don't. Just seem to somehow think there has to be contact for it to be relevant. I couldn't disagree more with them. They're consistent, but I consistently disagree with them. In my opinion, I don't know how you watch that race and don't see that Heiko had gone by the other horse, and then mysteriously the other horse came back, and then you watch the head on it. Junior is hitting left-handed, and the horse drifts 3 to 4 past. I'm not going to Junior. These riders are doing what the stewards let them do, and they're trying to win. So Junior's doing what the stewards have basically told them they can do, and he's trying to win. So I don't knock a rider for taking advantage of it, but I think herding is really dangerous, and it's totally out of control. And I just don't understand why they don't do something about it. But, you know, I've been saying this to you, Steve, as long as I've known you. So
yeah, yeah.
And nothing's changed, so I must once again be the idiot.
Well, and considering – in the context of, you mentioned dangerous, in the context of safety and the mania over, you know, over.
Well, I wouldn't say mania. There is a legitimate concern over safety. Mania is a difference, probably not the best choice of words. I know you're quite the wordsmith, Steve, but.
let's say.
Well, it's legitimate to be concerned about safety.
Yes, it is. Of course it is.
We should constantly be doing everything we can to make the game as safe as it can be. As safe as it can be. And I don't believe that condoning herding falls into that category.
I agree.
In fact, I'm sure it doesn't. I don't think that's an opinion. I think that's a fact. So I find it mystifying that it's not an issue that gets addressed. Well, listen, I find a lot of things mystifying in the game. And I feel it must be me.
No. This
but,
one...
But this one is puzzling to me and has been for years. And I don't knock the jockeys. They're doing what they're told they can get away with to win. And that's what their job is to do.
Yeah.
I mean, they're talking about the whips. I don't know. Feels like this is related, at the very least, if not more important. But
it's subtle, though. It's much more subtle. The whip thing is a visual that
it's not
that,
subtle if you know how to watch races and you watch head-ons.
It's subtle to the animal activists.
Well, you have to have the basic understanding of horses being herd animals, and that horses don't drift simultaneously. This notion that people saying, "Oh no." They were coming out together. No, they weren't. The outside horse was being herded out. He didn't just simultaneously drift at the same time the other horse's rider directed him out. Not like the riders that subtly, they're the ones that subtly cause their horses to go out while pretending they're trying to get them to go in.
Right.
These guys are very, very, very good at their jobs, and they know exactly what they're doing.
Yes.
But it's, once again, I'm screaming in an empty room because nobody cares.
Well, I don't know if we should go down this path, but do you want to address the carrying on over the Alan Jerkins stretch run where IRAD it was doing?
Well, there's an idiotic narrative on Twitter where people think that IRAD and Jose are colluding together to fix races. It's just an idiotic narrative, you know. It's hard to argue with people that just continue to push that concept, because it's just obviously not true. It's just not, you know. They're super competitive guys, and they're well aware that they'd be risking their entire careers if, in fact, they were doing something so stupid. I think what happened in that particular case, I mean, I think IRAD was a bit over the top, but listen, IRAD is as guilty of hurting as any rider out there. But that's another issue. And there was a race on Saturday at Gulfstream. I think it was the first race where, once again, mystifying, they didn't take his horse down. But that's a different issue. I do think that IRAD's actions in that race were at the top. They didn't have anything to do with the fact that his brother was in front with some 1-5 shot. It was obviously him tired of Paco Lopez's act. The thing I found so amusing about that whole thing is that suddenly all these people felt like the poor Paco Lopez was being, you know, unfairly treated. Even Paco would laugh at that. I mean, he's the roughest, probably most dangerous rider out there. I don't mean that, you know, I mean, let's be honest. This is a guy who's been pretty reckless at times. I saw him look over his shoulder, see Joel Rosario coming inside of him, and still cut him off. He got disqualified in the race, but he looked, he saw, and he came over. He's been involved in a lot of situations, right?
Of course.
So, suddenly people were afraid he was being wrong. I don't think Paco minded a little rough riding. He likes it.
Yeah.
I
agree 100%.
Yeah, it was an opportunity for this sort of preposterous, you know, grassy knoll crap about IRAD and Jose. It's just not true. I know both guys and like both guys. I also have not been afraid to criticize them at times. But that doesn't mean I don't have great respect for them. And also, there's a big difference between being critical of a ride they may give on a given day, and I'm sure they're critical of themselves. IRAD's very tough on himself. And you know, accusing them of cheating, that's quite a swing. It's an idiotic narrative by people on Twitter. You see it all the time. But if they'd focus more on trying to handicap and figure out what's going on in races and stop worrying everybody's fixing races all the time, they'd be a lot better off.
I'd laugh too. I mean, it's funny because I saw it.
Well, you can laugh, but there are
smoke signals.
Two people that are impugning the integrity of two people, which I don't think is funny.
Well, I'm saying about with Paco in particular, and when I went because I didn't see the race live, so I went and watched it, and seeing Irad just give him the business. If you can't see exactly what that was, for giving him a taste of his own medicine,
if he had been doing it to Johnny, I would have found it particularly surprising, but. When they did the Paco, it's like, yeah, okay, IRAD saw an opportunity to give back to Paco what he probably feels Paco's given to him. Well, I don't have a problem with aggressive riding within limits, you know, within limits of safety. But I'd rather, you know, I like when riders try to keep other riders in. It's something we talk about quite often. You know, sometimes you see a horse you have and he can't get out because a guy holds his ground, rolling him out. That's good race riding. I don't think riders should be just letting other guys out. If a guy gets himself into a pocket, that's his problem. And I think other riders should be there to take advantage of it. I don't fault that kind of riding. I don't fault aggressive riding. I think Angel Cordero is the greatest rider I've ever seen. He was as aggressive a rider as you'll ever see. I just think he was a brilliant rider as well. But he took no prisoners.
Well, that's another curious dialogue. How everybody, you know, everybody talks about the great old days and you know the hard charging riders of yesteryear, and then when those tactics are employed, there's a you and outcry.
Right. Yes,
what? Wait a minute.
That is an irony.
Yeah,
something.
You want Jacinto and Angel and Georgie? Okay.
Yeah, when Irad is riding like guys did back in the day, suddenly people were critical. It is fun. But I don't think that to suggest that it's nothing to do with his brother is to miss the point of what was going on.
Yes.
I don't really think it particularly occurred to him his brother was in front. And he certainly wasn't trying to prevent Pago from getting out to try to help his brother win the race. Give me a break. I mean, it's a distraction. You're just distracting yourself, right, when you get all caught up in that crap. You know, it reminds me of that horse that Joel Rosario rode back at Aqueduct about a month or so ago and was 1-5. And she shouldn't have been 1-5. She should have been 3 or 4-5. And, you know, everybody went wild after the race. Joel waited too long. He intentionally waited too long. Blah, 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 all this nonsense, you know, this stuff. And this was after getting an 80 buyer on a track that changed throughout the day because of weather. And I think a lot of figures may have been a bit high that day by other figure makers as well. Then she came back and ran a 78 while you know, Joel supposedly doing something to prevent her from running her best race. And then she came back at 3-5 and ran a 76 buyer with a different rider. So, you know, and one of my arguments to people on it was when you make this ridiculous assumption immediately after race that it was the rider, you know, manipulating things, you prevent yourself from trying to figure out what actually may have happened. And what actually happened is she's just not that good. And she ran a race and she ran second. And the next time she ran, and I liked her the next time she ran. I'm not pretending that I was so brilliant. And even if I had, I wouldn't pick the winner. But she came back and she ran even a little bit worse than when she got that supposed, you know, chicanery ride from Joelle. And crickets after the race, right? When I came out and said, you know, have people reevaluated? Where are those people now? Nobody said a word. And racing is about trying to figure out when you're wrong, right? It's easy to know when you're right. Or in best, you should figure out, was I really right or did I get lucky to be right? Or was I right for the reasons I thought I was right? But when you were wrong, and people were just wrong, they were just wrong. And what was their initial reaction? To blame the rider for cheating. I mean, give me a break. This is not what's going on. And if you really think it's going on, then why are you even playing? But it's not what's going on. And then the horse comes back and proves that, in fact, it wasn't the case. So, you know, it's just an unnecessary distraction. You're never going to learn anything you're doing if you assume that you ended up being incorrect because somebody cheated you. You know, the answer is to figure out your process, right? How you got there, and, you know, don't result it. You weren't necessarily wrong because you didn't win, and you weren't necessarily right because you did win, right?
Yeah.
That's the truth of crush the process, right? But don't muddy it up with these accusations of dishonesty. It's a waste of time, aside from being generally incorrect. It's a massive waste of time. Anyhow, can we move on to some other topic?
Well, we'll stay with riders, and we'll morph into a little bit of some other national results and then these Eclipse top vote getters. And on the jock front specifically, I was disappointed that Joel, I voted him first. And
well,
I know that I'm
not.
Well,
I could vote him over Irad.
I thought you could, and I'll be anxious to see the final. You know, they will reveal the certain percentage
well,
of the numbers
going away.
Yes, he will.
Listen, I think Joel rode great this year. I don't know how I'd quantify it, and I'm not going to don't want to weigh in with any particularly strong opinions on any of them. I thought Joelle had a terrific year of riding. I don't know what his numbers looked like. I don't vote. I don't look at those numbers. I don't really care. But I don't have an argument that Joelle rode great this year. No.
I forget who I brought this up. I think this came up with Jay Hovde the other day. And, you know, there's the numerical, when it comes to trainers.
Jay likes jockeys more than I do.
Well, and this wasn't necessary. Yes, he does. And this wasn't specifically. This was more a general human category issue, where it continues to seem that too often there's gravitating toward, you know, strictly the earnings list, and it. Really?
I agree with that. I agree with that. It's not just about the earnings. I don't disagree. And you'll prevent yourself from honoring somebody who's,
yes,
you know, done very well under the circumstances. The problem, though, is, Steve, that the vast majority of voters don't actually pay attention, which is why the Breeders' Cup winner has won Eclipse Awards in the past when they probably weren't the right winner. Because there's too many voters that are lazy. I do not want to condemn voters that do a good job, and I'm sure there are some. But I saw a ballot that had Bill Motless as the third leading trainer. Okay, with all due respect to Bill Mott, who's one of the all-time greatest trainers, I'm sure even Bill would do a double take if he saw that. He won two grade ones, right? One put up on a DQ in the Derby, and the other one was Channel Maker in the Man of War. I racked my brain and couldn't come up with another one, and you, in fact, confirmed it when you sent me data. Come on. Steve Asmussen had a great year. And I don't like Steve Asmussen. He's not very nice to me, by the way. But he had a great year. So how he isn't second to Chad Brown, and I understand that, once again, I'm talking about money's won, but, you know, Chad Brown had an exceptional year and multiple championships. And I'm not, you know, but how you have, and listen, I understand that Brad Cox, you know, is a legitimate too, but I don't know how Bill Mott would get into that. I don't know what people are looking at. I don't know. I can't get into the minds of people, but I do think that it probably would be better served with a responsible committee of less people making these decisions. Most of these are cut and dry, right?
It seems.
The human categories, occasionally there's more debate. You know, you would think with Karovich and, you know, Gary Barra being one, you know, in the voting, I imagine 1-2, you would assume that they'll get it right. Karovich will win. Gary Barber had a terrific year too. I didn't mean to knock him, but I mean, second,
no.
You know, you could see some votes for people, and it's just like, were you really paying attention, or were you voting for your friends or somebody you knew?
Now, this is always difficult, and I mean, I've advocated the last several years that, because I went back and I looked at my ballots, you know, all the way back to 2016, when I voted for Klarovich Lawrence, and that was a year that they weren't even
they've never been
weren't even.
But you know, listen, I disagree with you on a number of things every year, but out of respect, you pay a lot of attention, and I think your point about Joelle was, if you're not paying attention to racing, then he couldn't be on your radar. Whereas if you were, he might be. He might not be, but he might be.
And you know what's interesting, though? There have been examples, because when Jay made the point that he did, I think it was on the, I think it might have been on the breeding side, breeding or owner, but I noted that when Dale won,
Dale was a populist opinion that year.
And that was in 2012. And what was amazing, I went back because I wanted to see the earnings list, and Dale was fourth in earnings that year. And
yeah,
actually,
he had horses, right?
Yes. And Bill Mott, actually, the year before had, you know, broken the Pletcher Asmussen grasp on the award. And so there have been years where there was the deep dive done, and people recognized an opportunity.
Right. Well, maybe they had some horses that won Breeders' Cup races. They were prevalent in major races.
Right. Right.
You know, I'm sure that. I mean, Bill won. Was that the year that Bill won with
yes.
What's his name in the Classic?
Well, he won both. He won. He won the Classic and the Distaff
too. Right. And yeah, she was something. And those are years where it's right to honor Bill. But Bill didn't even have a particularly frontline player this year, right? The best he had was a late, and she was ultimately disappointing. And I love a late, but I mean, she was involved in one of the best races of the year. She just happened to come in
short.
I don't want to sell her short on that, but she's a wonderful horse. But anyway, I listen. Every year you see different votes you disagree with. I guess it's an imperfect system, and like most things, I don't know.
Hey, let me ask you. I want to ask you your thought on this, and I'm going to use obviously this year's specific horses, but it can come up in any year. When you look and you think about a category, now they've delineated older dirt male versus turf. This goes back to the Wise Dan, dominance. But within the subcategory, when you pit Vino Rosso, Mottoli, and McKenzie, when you have a, Mottoli is going to be the sprint champion.
I would give it to Mottoli.
You would give it to Mottoli over Vino.
Right, unless they want to say it's for routers.
It's really funny. What's your Covfefe 3-year-old view?
Well, let me just say something else, Steve. Bricks and Mortar was the very likely horse of the year, also won Turf Horse.
Yes.
So why can't you win two categories?
Well, you can. Horse of the Year to me is a standalone anyway. The Horse of the Year is an anointment.
Okay. And Covfefe is going to probably win female sprinter and 3-year-old filly champion.
She is. She absolutely, and deservedly. Deservedly. Mm-hmm. Could not put Serengeti, Guarana, Dunbar, Concrete Rose. Covfefe was the best 3-year-old filly.
Top 3 is dopey, but.
I don't think so, but all right.
It is dopey. It's dopey.
I don't think so.
It is dopey, but okay, go ahead.
But
I know Rusty's one of your favorite guests in the show, so you had to vote for Concrete Rose. So when he came on, you could say, Rusty, I put Concrete Rose in the top 3. And he'd say, okay, I'll come on whenever you need me, Steve. He would come on anyway.
He comes on anyway.
You were sucking up. That's okay.
No, that's not fair. Concrete Rose...
Yes.
That she was out of sight, out of mind the last quarter, but she.
No, you rate the Saratoga Oaks a lot more highly than I do. But hey, you're more of a company guy than I am.
Too funny.
So where were we? So you say Covfefe can win both those categories, but in other words, you're saying, but poor Vito Rosso should win an award. I mean, I'm not. Vito Rosso had a terrific year, but he also had. He had kind of an odd year, right?
He kind of did.
If he won the Gotham of Gold Cup, then Maximum Security won the Derby, right?
That's fair. I'd like to try to acknowledge
I'm not
as many.
If somebody votes for Vino Rosso, by the way, I would vote for Mottoli. That's all.
Mottoli was amazing. It was a tremendous, just a tremendous season. There's no doubt. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. It was a weird year. And, it's not like there have never been turf horses that have won Clips Awards. And certainly Bricks and Mortar probably has a better case than Cotechan did, right? Of course, who were the other choices behind Cotechan that year? I guess Bertrando, right?
Oof.
I wonder who was second to him. Perfect years, right?
Well, that's the one that always seems to get trotted
Listen,
out for
I thought
this
the
discussion.
Admiral should have gotten the Eclipse Award over Ferdinand in 1987. I thought the problem was Theatrical was the second best turf horse, right? Because Manila blew him off the racetrack in the Arlington Million. But Theatrical, I also think he won, including that phony DQ in the Bowling Green, which was the Sword Dancer, when they took Dance of Life down and won by 5 lengths, and they never should have. But regardless, since he did get placed first, I think he won 7 grade ones between February and November, and he beat Trampolino in that Breeders' Cup, so won the Arc. So I thought he got robbed that year. But I also really like theatrical.
And I'm trying to look, and let me look at champions.
I want to ask another question.
Yeah.
Just to stir things up.
Oh,
and it's actually a serious question. Somebody I know brought this up. Craig brought this up last night. Considering the potentially, particularly unstable, possible situation in the Middle East, are there any people that are reconsidering the possibility of planning to skip the Pegasus and go to the Saudi Cup?
I've not seen.
Well, I mean, it's a serious question. I don't
no, sure, it's a serious question.
Guy, I'm not trying to make some political statement at all. And it's nothing to do with how I feel about, you know, the Saudi Cup. It's a legitimate question. I understand it's a lot of big difference in money. How confident are these people that they're really going to want to go over there or be able to go over there?
Fair question.
I mean, it has to be at least somewhat of a concern, and certainly a bigger concern than it was a week ago, right?
Yeah. Yeah. The absolutely legitimate question. Has there been, you said you saw some chatter last night in that regard?
Well, no, Craig brought it up last night, and it was a very good point. Yeah. Maybe you get Prince Bandar on. He's probably an avid listener of the show.
That'll be that'll be special. I'll get Tony Randall, too, that same day.
One of them is dead, Steve. You might not be sure because you recently thought Tony was alive.
It wasn't recently. It's about 4 or 5 years ago now. But
yeah, it feels like recently. Feels like just the other day.
It's an inside baseball joke, folks.
I just think it's a legitimate question. I don't.
No, it's 100% legitimate. It's a great question, and we'll see what.
The other thing I was thinking about is that I understand it's not Maximum Security's connection's fault that Omaha Beach is retiring after the Pegasus, and I'm not criticizing the owners for taking the money to retire them. You've got to take money off the table, but it would have been nice if they could have had one meeting. You know.
Yeah, and I said to, in fact, I said yesterday to Richard Mandela.
I'm sure he would have welcomed it. I don't think he's looking to knock anybody. He's going to sleep at night whether he wins or loses the race.
I guess I had this talk with you. I brought it up with Jay yesterday. How the three 3 year olds all had these sort of, you know, season interruptus.
Imperfect, very imperfect.
Right? Yes.
It's very imperfect, like very unique.
Yeah, exactly. They all missed significant portions.
They all did some terrific things at different times during the season.
Yeah.
But they all, well, you know, I don't, Code of Honor only missed, you know, that 2 month period. He did race fully through into May, and he raced fully after. Well, I mean, he did, you know, he skipped theoretically to Jim Dandy or Haskell. But, you know, in fairness to him, the thing with him was he had a very imperfect season leading into the second half of the season, right?
Yes. Yes.
He was easily beaten by Maximum Security the one time they met. I don't think it's the be-all and end-all. And if I were to say, out of those three, which horse do I personally prefer? I just like Code of Honor. I'm just kind of a fan. And I'm, you know, occasionally a bit of a homer. And I like to see Shug do well. But I wouldn't have voted for him for 3-year-old champ. If I could have voted for the horse I wish had won, I would have voted for him. But I wouldn't have done that. I would have voted for Maximum Security. As you know, I'm not his biggest fan.
Agreed. And it you know, you look at the campaigns, you look at the, and they're all of high quality, and and frankly, you know who gets lost in this discussion, and I know that you weren't a fan when it came up in September, October, but Spun to Run with his late season emergence and, you know, the races that he put together,
his entire year
is not
laughable. But his end-of-the-year run was very good. But then he met Maximum Security. Maximum Security flipped him off like a gnat.
Yep. Yep. in the Cigar Mile.
Which is a credit to Maxim Security, not a criticism of Fun to Run, who clearly had two very different seasons. He had a season leading up to that race at Parks, and then he had the three, you know, the Parks race, the Breeders' Cup, and the Cigar. And, you know, listen, he's probably a contender in what's looking like a very strong five-horse field for the Pegasus if things don't change. But hey, wouldn't it be fitting?
Okay, you got me.
I'm trying to figure out how it's harder to get a field for the race now that people don't have to put up fake money. I mean, at least they had to put up some fake money, right? Some real money and all the fake money. Now they don't have to put any up and nobody wants to run. No, that's right, because that's another race.
Well, it's amazing how... we'll see what happens with the political aspect that you very rightly.
Well, I mean,
you bring up, but
it doesn't feel like it's going to go away overnight.
No, it doesn't,
sure.
And
probably gets worse before it gets better. I don't want to get into a political discussion, but I just think that if you're somebody who is thinking of making that unfortunate decision to go there, you might be I'm sure they're at least thinking about the possibility that they may want to reconsider. I'll put it that way.
Well,
doesn't mean they will.
Here's what right now, as of right now, in this minute, you've got Omaha Beach, Higher Power, Mr. Freeze, Roadster, Seeking the Soul, Spun to Run, and Tax left, seven horses left from the invitees that aren't thinking about going, to the...
Are any of them also considering the stymie?
Check with Andrew Byrne on that. But Giftbox, Math Wizard, Maximum Security, and McKinsey all seemingly headed.
Why is McKinsey running?
He's going there too. He's pointing for Saudi Tuna.
All right, I'm done. I got stuff to do. You must have many, many great guests waiting in the wings. I've overstayed my welcome.
No, you were fabulous, and we made up for the two holiday period visits. And
was Tina doing the driving when you guys were going back from Philadelphia?
Yes.
Okay. It was great talking to you. I just wanted to clarify that. It sounded like she was driving.
No, she. These days, she's doing all the driving.
She doesn't trust your driving.
Correct.
Or because she's really the man in the relationship.
Let me tell you, both. Let me tell you, she doesn't trust me going down into the basement anymore. I banged my head the other day.
She's rising up.
Because my spatial whatever.
Oh, right. You only have one eye, I forgot.
It's a disaster. Right. It's not good. You should,
and it wasn't easy being Steve Bick before that. So
exactly. So now it's now precisely.
Okay. Well, I hope that the new year brings you sight.
Clarity. Clarity is more important than sight, right?
We can all use some clarity.
Andy okay, Serling, everybody. You. Racing resumes Thursday at Aqueduct. And I'd love to go down. We got Minute Mouse running Thursday in the third. Taking a break here. John White, we'll go to John here. We got John White coming, and we'll go over a lot of the racing that we haven't gotten to yet about Santa Anita. I got plenty of other news pieces I got to slip in. In fact, I don't know if we'll get... I was thinking of reaching out for Marcus Hirsch to talk this Illinois contract. The Illinois situation is not good. Arlington, things are fine at Hawthorne, but no contract between CDI and the Illinois Horsemen when it comes to Arlington. And part of that gaming bill included provision that they were supposed to have a contract in place by year end, as opposed to the start of meets. So we keep an eye on that, but there was a couple of passings that I do want to slip in, and I'll note quickly here before we go. Lou Goldfein, Mickey Goldfein's father, passed at age 99 last week living in California, and the Goldfeins are you know, Chicagoland Racing institution. Lou Goldfein, Shecky Green, among his trainees. And he had, actually, he had It's in the Air as a two-year-old when she was champion. Thoughts go out to Mickey and the extended family. A lot of good. He had a lot of good horses, Lou Goldfein. Trained from the mid-60s to 2000. 35-year career. So wanted to mention that. And I also, when it came to Marcus, I wanted to bring up another passing. I told you yesterday there were no shortage of sad notes on this front. At age 61, thoughts to the Schusters, John Schuster, who RTIP grad, Arizona grad, and longtime GM at Indiana. Four daughters and wife Janie. And thoughts in their direction as well. Let's take a time out. John White is going to join us. And I got one for him, too, a name from the Pacific Northwest. Pat Mullins at 92 last week. Back after this, John White.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Developed by Horstman, HorseBills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, environment-friendly, paperless revolution of how equine industries bill and receive payments. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for each horse, whose owners can pay through the same website with just one click. Say goodbye to stacks of invoices, handwritten checks, and postage costs. Easy accounting for all parties with the highest online security measures. Get started free at HorseBills.com. Simply register with your name and email address. Free to sign up. No subscription fees to vendors until the first invoice. Voices sent. For owners, you get a free account, comprehensive dashboard with information on all horses owned and billing records, ACH and credit card payment options. For vendors, generate invoices efficiently and receive payments quickly from both owners and other vendors. Syndicate and partnership managers get flexible billing and payment options to both vendors and syndicate members. For more info, call 888-938-4643, 888-938-4643, or log on to horsebills.com. That's horsebills.com.
Get started in Kentucky. Over $8 million in additional purse money is available at the five Kentucky tracks for horses eligible for the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund. Kentucky is a good place to race your Kentucky bred. Come home to Kentucky and make a start.
DRF Sports Forum Digital Edition, your ultimate weekly betting guide. Published by Daily Racing Form, DRF Sports Forum delivers all of the analysis and insight you need for every NFL game and more than 40 college football matchups. Beat the spread with powerful trends and sharp angles. Tap into best bets, expert picks, parlay winners, and more. All for just $4.99 per issue. Get this week's edition free. Visit drf.com/sportsforum. Enter code DRF Sports.
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
Do you ever wonder what happens to your old friends, including the great champions that inspired unforgettable memories, and maybe even let you cash a ticket or two over the years? We even have a former child prodigy.
Here is a superstar. That horse's name is Afternoon Delights. And Kit, the song on Afternoon Delights, absolutely galloping in the Hollywood Futurities.
These are the champions that help out the horses that might not have won a Grade 1 race, but always tried just as hard. Come visit them all at Old Friends when you're in Kentucky, or at our Bobby Frankel division, Old Friends in Saratoga. I know they'll be glad to see you. Go to oldfriendsequine.org or call us at 502-863-1775.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Where's the tiger? Can't find the tiger. Lost the tiger. Ain't seen the tiger. Where's the tiger?
We're back at the races, about a little less than 10 minutes to the top of the hour. Going to have a visit with Jeremy Plonk in a little bit. And Jeremy, got a variety of things for Jeremy, including the launch of Countdown to the Crown for 2020. And Jeremy was the host, of course, this week, this weekend of Beat the Host. John White will do some hosting duties in a couple more weeks, and he joins us now. John, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Steve, and I've already printed out my first Countdown to the Crown for 2020, so I don't know if there's a bigger Countdown to the Crown fan than yours truly, but there might be, but I doubt it. Jeremy, you put it well. The job he does with that Countdown to the Crown is just fabulous.
It's such a great resource, and in one place you can go, and you know, I think we all know a lot of the top line horses and you know, the headline types that are pointing for, you know, the various spots as they begin to unfold, and you know, they'll start to come in earnest, you know, next week with the LeCompte. What I like about it is, you know, the Jeremy, particularly January, February, and into early March, is also keeping tabs of the maiden and allowance winners, you know, that are looking to take next steps. And, you know, that portion of it, you know, because, you know, I basically print out and will have it, you know, in a binder, most of the maiden special weight winners that come along, you know, from July to December. And then, you know, after these next couple of weeks, you know, we get into, you know, by Fountain of Youth, essentially, you know, it's getting a little late for maiden winners that aren't named Justify to, you know, to jump into the deep end of the pool. So Jeremy keeping track of those horses that are, you know, maybe one step behind the headliners, that's a great resource.
Well, it certainly is, and another thing that I give Jeremy a lot of credit for, and I say this as someone who called charts for the Daily Racing Form for 20 years or so, including the 1986 Breeders' Cup Classic, 1987 Breeders' Cup Classic, which was my favorite chart that I ever called when Ferdinand nosed out Ali Sheba in a showdown of two Kentucky Derby winners with the Horse of the Year title on the line, and a just absolutely sensational ride by Bill Shoemaker in the twilight of his career on Ferdinand, who was a tricky horse to ride because he would pull himself up once he made the lead, and Shoemaker sat there with ice water in his veins coming down the stretch waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting to ask Ferdinand to run, and when he did, coming to the 16th pole, Ferdinand responded, took the lead, and here came the three-year-old Ali Sheba with Chris McCarron flying on a track that wasn't too kind to horses coming from as far back as Ali Sheba. And Ali Sheba just ran a tremendous race to lose in a photo finish, but that ride by Shoemaker was yet another illustration of his greatness. And so, I mean, I called many charts at Keystone and from Keystone to Long Acres to many years here on the Southern California circuit, the Louisiana Downs. And Jeremy can go through a race about as good as anybody I've ever seen. In fact, you talk about Countdown to the Crown. I remember how he went through with a fine-tooth comb on Omaha Beach's performance in the Arkansas Derby, and he made the statement that Omaha Beach motored around the clubhouse turn like Secretariat's 1973 Preakness when Ron Turcotte took a gamble blowing past the Col de Taj, and Jeremy broke it down fraction-wise, and it really pointed out what a performance that was by Omaha Beach at that time, which that is why, to a large extent, he was installed as the 4-1 boarding line favorite by Mike Battaglia for the Kentucky Derby. But, I mean, that you don't see horses make a move on the first turn in a route race like that and still win the race very often. It takes a very special colt to do that. And Jeremy was the one that was right on top of that at the time. He pointed out, in fact, that the final three furlongs that Omaha Beach ran that day of 37.45 fit right there with Curlin, who was 37 and change, Bodemeister, 37 and change, and American Pharoah in 37 and change. And that's one reason I really liked Omaha Beach to win the Kentucky Derby, because when you're running your final three furlongs in the Arkansas Derby, pretty much on a par with Curlin, Bodemeister, and American Pharoah, it shows that you have the capability, certainly, of winning the Run for the Roses on the first Saturday of May. But again, I compliment Jeremy for the information he provides and just how sharp he is and how much information he provides. And then I also am very always interested in his list, you know, which he's come up with his top 20 for 2020 so far. And I was very interested to see that he has Honor AP, who's based here in Southern California, still at number one, even though Jeremy pointed out that he was forced to miss the Sham. So it isn't like he had Honor AP atop this list before knowing that that Honor AP had this setback, which caused him to miss the Sham. So the fact that Jeremy kept him at number one, I thought, is interesting, because there's certainly a ton to like with Honor AP here. Hopefully, whatever the issue is, and we're Brad Free, who of course does a tremendous job as well for the Daily Racing Form, reported yesterday that Honor AP, they're waiting for the diagnostics. Sheriff says so. I'm crossing my fingers and just hoping for Honor AP's sake that it's nothing serious. If it is something serious, obviously would likely really make it dubious in terms of that first Saturday of May. So I'm just hoping it was some kind of a minor setback that caused him out of the Sham. If it was a minor setback, you would think he could come back in the Lewis here at the start of February and get back on track for the Kentucky Derby. But so that's going to be key to find out what these diagnostics are for Honor AP.
Well, and we'll let Jeremy flesh out his early season thoughts. Got a few things, John. I want to get into the opening day through Sunday action at Santa Anita, and I also want to talk. You had your Eclipse reveal, so we'll do some of that. Before we get to that, I don't know if you caught the name I mentioned. I had just all the stack of things that happened between December 24th and Sunday while we were on break. And undoubtedly, you can provide an appreciation for Pat Mullins, who a veteran horseman in the Northwest for many, many years. And he passed last week at 92.
Yeah, he was something of a kind of a Northwest legend up there for sure, and trained for many, many years. Very respected trainer. Trained well late into his life, like some trainers do. And like I say, he was very well thought of by his colleagues, and was a very classy guy, and operated a very, a very good operation. And that was kind of sad news. Certainly the Gary Sherlock news, that was also sad news. I mean, that guy, I can remember so many days in the press box at Hollywood Park. He would sit next to Jerry Antonucci, who was the handicapper for the Herald Examiner newspaper, which was a really terrific newspaper here in Los Angeles because they covered racing much better than the Los Angeles Times. And you had, for a long time, you had Gordon Jones and Jerry Antonucci for the L.A. Herald Examiner, and then Bob Mazursky came in and took the place of Gordon Jones, and, you know, they just really did a good job. And Jerry was really close friends with Gary Sherlock, and Gary was, you know, just as friendly a guy and really did a good job as a trainer, and as been pointed out on your show, he made the transition very successfully from the quarter horses over to the thoroughbreds. He was very actually respected in the insurance business, which he did for a number of years, and the horse insurance, and he was just one of those guys that whenever you had the chance to talk to him, you enjoyed it. He had good stories and was just a first-class individual, and he's really missed by the Southern California racing community for sure.
Well, and I'm going to bring him up again with at the end of the week with Jeff Siegel. But John Wilson, too, John, and, you know, the clocking, the Southern California clocking community are basically the origins of what is now a proliferated, you know, availability of clocking information. And I with Jay Pribman yesterday, and Jay had written the obit for the DRF, and I termed Wilson a kind of the godfather of that information. And another over the holiday period, this was a rough couple of weeks.
Yes, I mean, he was really a pioneer in that, and think of what we have today in terms of these workout reports. So that was certainly a major passing. And then there was another one not too long ago in the Pacific Northwest. Troy Taylor passed away at the age of 88, and he was a real legend.
Oh, wow.
A real legend in the Northwest, and trained. He had a lot of success in Northern California, and especially at Hastings in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Yeah.
He won a number of training titles at Hastings, but he also won training titles at Portland Meadows and Playfair in my hometown. He trained over 130 stakes winners alone for Glenn Todd. And Glenn Todd, who was a trainer in the 1970s and 80s, he was so close with Troy Taylor, and Glenn Todd has actually taken his trainer's license back out again and won the Grade 3 British Columbia Derby last year.
Yeah.
As the owner and trainer of Five Star General. But this one really hit at home, close to home to me, because Troy Taylor trained one of the most important horses of my life, and that was a filly by the name of Turn to Fire. And when back in 1972, I was waiting and waiting and waiting to find a race to make my first $100 bet, and I really wanted to win the bet. I didn't want to lose my first $100 bet, and so I was just trying to find the right spot. And Turn to Fire, the year before, as a three-year-old, had been an absolute superstar at Long Acres. She had beaten older fillies and mares. She had beaten the boys and was far and away the top three-year-old filly at Long Acres. She went to the sidelines in the summer. A lot of people were hoping that she would run against Rockbath, who was the top three-year-old male at Long Acres in 1971. He was the son of Cavan, and a real come-from-behind horse, one of those Silky Sullivan types. But Turn to Fire got hurt. She returned to the races in the spring of 1972 at Golden Gate, ran four times, had a couple of wins, a second and third, and showed up for the Fashion Handicap on Memorial Day weekend in 1972, a race that she had won the year before as a three-year-old. And so, I mean, if she could win that race as a three-year-old filly, I'm figuring she's a dead mortal lock to win it as a four-year-old filly. And so I chose her for my first $100 bet. She was coupled in the wagering with a filly by the name of Batted a Princess. And Fleet Ahead, who had been the horse of the year at the Playfair meeting the year before, was a contender in the race. But like I say, I thought Turn to Fire was a cinch. It was a 6-furlong race. And turning for home, my hands are all sweaty from my first $100 bet. And it looks like Turn to Fire is not going to fire. And Banada Princess was setting the pace. And so as a true horse player, when it looked like the horse I was really betting was not going to get the job done, I started rooting for the other filly on the lead, hoping she'd bail me out. And Fleet Ahead took the lead in the final 16th, and my heart sank, and I thought I was dead. And Turn to Fire with Larry Pierce aboard, turned on the afterburners and made just this absolutely phenomenal rally. And it was so close. I was standing next to the winner's circle with my dad, and we didn't know. It was so close, we couldn't tell who won. And sure enough, Turn to Fire had won by a nose. And Troy Taylor trained Turn to Fire.
Well, and I had not seen that news, John. And we talked to Glenn earlier, you know, last year, and he explained about him, you know, resuming his training. And gosh, that's tough.
Glenn had done that after Troy had retired, and so Troy had retired for a few years here just before his death. And but you know, Troy Taylor trained a horse that by the name of Taylor Said for Glenn Todd, and Troy sent the horse to Mike Pewich at Long Acres for the Long Acres Mile, and Taylor Said did win the Long Acres Mile for Glenn Todd, but Troy Taylor was the regular trainer of that horse, and in fact, the rider of Taylor Said in that Long Acres Mile was a jockey by the name of Mario Gutierrez.
Right.
Who earlier that year in 2012 had won the Kentucky Derby, of course, and the Preakness with I'll Have Another. In fact, that's the jockey that you got into the elevator with at Pimlico, and it looked like...
Churchill.
Oh, at Churchill, I should say. Yeah, and it's what I always think back to that when you talked about how you were, how you felt Mario was just, you know,
deer
so
in the headlights.
Kind of overwhelmed about the whole situation there.
Exactly, and Taylor and Todd contributed mightily to his origins in the Pacific Northwest. Wow, Troy Taylor, and he's one of those horsemen that when you go to look at stats, they're woefully incomplete because the equibase numbers.
Sure, there's no doubt about that.
They don't include, you know, nearly the, you know, the number of starters and winners. You know, the Equibase has got Taylor with just under 1,000 wins, but it way incomplete, even going back into the 60s statistically. So I'm glad you mentioned it. I had not heard, and I see that it was at the age of 88. Troy Taylor. Thanks for that, John. Let's take a look, John, at what's gone on. You're back, of course, doing the selections for the Santa Anita program and getting the morning line in order. And the decision to push back the opening to Saturday, the 28th, really worked out well for everybody and made for a great opening day. Some thoughts about, you know, some of the performances, what's registered with you?
Well, certainly Omaha Beach, as everyone has talked about. And, of course, I'm a huge Omaha Beach fan. I put him on my Kentucky Derby top 10 last year off his maiden win. You know, that race right there was such a light switch on, a light bulb on for him that day in the slop. When he opened up 10, turning for home, and won by 9, 8 and change, he went the three quarters, 121 for the final. And look, he beat One Bad Boy that day. All One Bad Boy would do is go on to win the Queen's Plate, and Omaha Beach absolutely annihilated him. And I actually received some criticism at the time for throwing Omaha Beach into my Kentucky Derby top 10 off a maiden win. And needless to say, what he has gone on to do more than verifies that that was not an off-the-base decision to do that. And it's just a shame, as we've said. When you think that a horse of the horses in recent years, like California Chrome and Gunrunner and these horses, what they did as four-year-olds, you know, and further back, you think of Seattle Slough as a four-year-old and Affirmed as a four-year-old, Spectacular Bid as a four-year-old. I mean, what these horses can do at four when they really are more mature even, and, you know,
sure,
than when they're three. I mean, with Omaha Beach, it would just, my mouth waters at what he could accomplished perhaps this year as a four-year-old, and it's just a shame. I mean, as Andy Serling said, you can't knock the people for taking the money off the table, and you get it. I mean, and you've said it too. I mean, you've said it well. I mean, these people have invested a lot into this game, and when you get something like this, you know, you just have to cash in the chips. I mean, it really is, it just makes sense. But when I see someone like Beholder race as long as she did, and of course there's a big difference between a female thoroughbred and a stallion prospect. But still, I mean, just to get one more year out of Omaha Beach, and of course we never got that one more year out of Secretariat either, so it does happen that we're disappointed by that. But I did think Roadster actually ran a pretty good race here too, that's been overlooked. You know, people were so high on him coming out of the Santa Anita Derby, and I actually thought his race in the Damascus was pretty darn good against Flagstaff. I mean, they threw it down in the final furlong in that race, and I didn't think Roadster, off a layoff, lost anything in defeat in that performance. And yes, he laid an egg in the Native Diver, but he came back and got, you know, ran his, a good race, I thought, in the Malibu. The disappointment was Complexity there, who had shipped in off the big win for Chad Brown. And boy, he was a big disappointment at 2-1 in that race. And Mo Forza has turned into an absolute beast. He's kind of similar to Omaha Beach in that Omaha Beach lost his first four races and then won four in a row. And Mo Forza, he struggled in the maiden ranks and lost his first five races, and now he's won four in a row. So a real similarity from that standpoint in the two forms. And this Mo Forza, you really got to give Peter Miller a lot of credit here. This son of Uncle Mo has just blossomed. And, of course, as you said, Barry Abrams has been telling us that even before this horse ever ran, how good he was. So Barry certainly proved right. You know, I always think of Barry because I remember talking with Mike Mitchell one time, and it was Mike Mitchell who Barry Abrams outshook to get Unusual Heat, who would turn out to be one of the greatest California sires in history. And one day I was sitting there at the Santa Anita walking ring and on a bench with Mike Mitchell. We were just chatting, and that was back when I was doing the simulcast commentary for all those years for Santa Anita. And somehow it came up about Unusual Heat. Mike says, you know, I was the guy that Barry had to outshake for that horse. And he says, people don't realize how important it was that Barry won that shake because I was going to geld them. So if you think of Mike Mitchell getting that horse and gelding him and all those sons and daughters of Unusual Heat never being born, that is mind-boggling to contemplate. So that is certainly one for the books. But and then I thought really one of the most impressive performances, and it was absolutely dazzling for the trainer who you voted for third on your Eclipse Award ballot. And you know what? I think that wasn't bad at all to put Richard Baltus third on your ballot. But Venetian Harbor, that race that she ran to earn her maiden diploma, that was just eye-popping, I thought. And she got a 94 buyer. Turned out to be the second biggest buyer by a two-year-old filly in the whole country for 2019. So this is a filly who, a daughter of Munnings out of a Streetcar mare, who I think has an extremely bright future. She had lost her career debut as an even money favorite to another Richard Baltus trainee, actually, on the turf. And boy, when he switched this Venetian Harbor to the dirt, wow.
I'm glad you mentioned it, because that's one of those under the radar performances from the holiday season. And it wasn't like she was a secret either. I mean, she was even money. And the fact that, and of course, the fact that Ron Anderson, you know, got Rosario hooked up with her, that also, you know, speaks to, you know, what was in the offing with Venetian Harbor. But she won by, you know, 10 plus lengths, and we'll see. You know, I want to get to Baltus between Lady Prancelot's return to form, and you know, she wins as a favorite 3-2. Joe Bravo, as we call him, the Jackal, comes in and wins in these spots. And you know, another maiden win right from the start of the meet. I haven't seen much follow-up yet to Devil Made Me Do Its win that opened the whole season. Doug O'Neill's runner, speaking of Mario Gutierrez, 3-2 favorite in the opener, 87 buyer for the debut.
And just drew off, won by 9.5, and they're very high on him at the O'Neill Barn. And he could certainly become a major player on the Kentucky Derby Trail this year, no question about it in my mind. So you're right. We had a very exciting maiden win right out of the box at Santa Anita, that is for sure. And you mentioned Lady Prancelot. You know, we're excited here in California because her sire, Sir Prancelot, is going to stand at stud here in a shuttle situation where he's going to shuttle between Australia and California. He began his stud career in Ireland, and then he had stood some in Australia. Now he's going to shuttle between Australia and here. But I'll tell you what, he looks like he could be any kind of sire. In fact, there are some people in Kentucky that are actually sending mares to him in California, and that's it's almost always the other way around. We here in California will send a broodmare to Kentucky to be bred, especially with the California breeding rules where you could breed to a Kentucky stallion. And as long as you come back the next year and breed again to a California sire stallion, then that one by the Kentucky sire can be a cowbred. So, and we see some of those where you go, how in the world is this one a cowbred? And that's because of that system they have in place for that. So we're pretty excited about this sire of Lady Prancelot going to stud in here in California, and that could be a lot of fun to see the sons and daughters of that sire running here in the United States. We'll have a lot more of them than this sprinkling that we've had, because from what we've seen of the small sample size,
agreed.
Boy, he looks like a really terrific sire.
Very productive, and in fact, we brought this up probably mid-year last year. There was a weekend. I'm going to assume when Lady Prancelot had won another stake, and there was another Sir Prancelot that had won in North America as well. And I'll do this tomorrow with Sid. There's quite a bit of shuttle news and so forth, including World of Trouble, who is going to shuttle between Hillendale and Australia. So we'll hit some of those highlights. A couple of other notes, John, from the opening salvos. We've had six race days. Is that right? Yeah, six race days, and six or seven, and one of the things I noticed was particularly the jocks winning in bunches. You know, Mike Smith with the four stake wins on opening day, including the record-breaking performance to go past Jerry Bailey. Joel Rosario won three on opening day, came back with two on the second day of the meet. Abel Cedillo wins four. Then Pratt and Drayden Van Dyke started to swing into action and ring up wins. Fuentes as well with the multiple win days. It very interesting, you know, coming out of the blocks and knock on wood. I know there's been both a race and a training pair of incidents, but does feel like we've got a bit of a return to normalcy here to get these first 2 weeks of the season underway.
Well, Cedillo was one of the big stories in Southern California in 2019, without any question. The way he transferred, so to speak, down from Northern California and made such a huge splash. And, boy, talk about a bright future for that rider, no doubt about it. And I'll tell you what, I'm a big Fuentes fan. That horses run for that young fella. He's got kind of that magical element to him to where it's the X factor to me, to where you just see horses, they just run for that guy. And
yep.
He's been a little early in his career, which isn't too unusual, to where he would cross the line and get himself into pickles in terms of disqualifications and suspensions. But I had a chat with him last summer when I had a week where I worked as a steward at Los Alamitos at the summer meet. In fact, that was when Game Winner won the Los Alamitos Derby, but Fuentes came in and had been involved in an incident coming down to the finish. And I implored him to really make as big an effort as he can to stay straight, because I said, you'll find how little trouble and how rarely you'll be in the steward's office here if you just, the more you can stay straight out there on that course. And I said, anytime you start coming in or going out, you know, sometimes you won't get disqualified because in the judgment of the stewards, it didn't affect the opportunity of someone for a better placing, so you'll get lucky, but you could still get days. And I said, you're just too talented to keep coming in here all the time. So my feeling is that I'd like to see that happens with him, because, as I say, I think he's just got a world of talent, and he's got that magical X factor where horses just run for that young rider.
I want to mention one other rider before we shift gears and I let you riff on your Eclipse thoughts. Umberto Rispoli, and no, he's not a character in Godfather 4. he's the young rider that Ron Anderson has added to the arsenal, and Rispoli has come out of the blocks. You know, you kind of before the calendar turned, I think he was 0-10 and has subsequently won his first three races in North America. And congratulations to Rispoli. And he's getting into some nice barns, including Mullins and Baltus. And he won for Eric Kruljack and Mike Pipey. In fact, I think he won for Pipey on opening day. So that's the new name that you're seeing, Umberto Rispoli.
Well, and evidently, Mr. Rispoli made an offer to Ron Anderson that Ron couldn't refuse, to take his book. And this guy, there's no doubt about his riding ability in my mind. I mean, look, you can see this guy's as good, you know, as you're going to get. There's no problem with him. To me, if you're a horse player, you don't have to worry about him being a problem. Of course, there's always, you know, racing luck, but this guy can ride as well as really anybody we got here, quite frankly. So
he's 30, you know, he's 30 years old and has got, you know, international experience, including in Hong Kong. And I mean, he's a top rider. I mean, he's not.
Yep, that's a good way to put it. He's a top rider. That's perfectly put.
John, a couple of minutes before Jeremy Plonk joins us, give us, for those that haven't seen your Express Bet column and your big Eclipse reveal.
Well, George Starbridge will probably get Breeder. There's been so much talk about Breeder, and he's very deserving, and probably I should have voted for him. I mean, I'll be honest, I voted for Calumet Farm. And the way the discussion has gone, I feel like maybe I was completely off base here or something. But I will tell you this, while people say they a lot of times, well, the earnings, you shouldn't just look at that. Well, I didn't just look at the earnings, but I also think a case can be made for whoever is, in terms of owner or breeder or jockey or apprentice jockey, earnings, they do tell a tale. You know, back when I was reading the form in my early years, back in the 60s with my father, he used to tell me, and there's a lot of truth to this, when you look at a horse's form, one of the most important things you can look at for a horse is how much money they've made, because it's indicative of what kind of races they've been running in. And it's the truth. I mean, if you look at a horse in just a race on like a Thursday in Maryland, that, like you were talking about with Michael Trombetta, you look on a race there and you say, wow, this horse, you know, has made $240,000 and the rest of the field, nobody else has made that much money. You can start right there and say, gee, that horse has been doing something and keeping some pretty good company. And I don't think it's too out of line to reward the people that put a lot into this game. You know, you've talked about the investment that these people have put in. Boy, you know, Calumet Farm, you talk about the investment that has been put into this game by the current Calumet Farm operation. It's staggering. The guy has meant a lot to this sport. And, so he hasn't had as many grade one wins as some others. And that's a valid point. I have no problem with people, you know. Like I say, I think Mr. Strawbridge will win, and he probably should win. But I just felt strong year overall for their operation, so I put them first. And I know I voted for somebody that won't win, but that doesn't bother me because
no.
Be it politics, when I go to the voting booth there, or in horse racing, I've been voting in the Eclipse Award since 1976, and there's been many a time when I have voted for somebody that I felt deserved it, you know, but they weren't going to win it. So, I that doesn't bother me either. So, and Bricks and Mortar, I think, is a slam dunk for Horse of the Year. I listened very strongly to what Andy Beyer. Look, I respect Andy Beyer. This guy didn't just fall up the turnip truck here. And he made a very compelling case for Maximum Security as Horse of the Year. I have no problem for anybody that votes for Maximum Security. I have no problem for anybody that voted for Matoli. And you mentioned that you had Midnight Bazoo third. I don't have any problem who put Midnight Bazoo in the mix for Horse of the Year either, quite honestly. So now if you go beyond those, if you're going to put somebody else on there besides any of those four, then I'm saying I don't know about that. But, and the most important thing, and you have said this, and I agree with you, the most important thing that we're voting for is whoever we're putting first. And sometimes, you know, when we get down to who we're putting third, I put Maxfield third. And a lot of people, like, Dennis's Moment in their three. And look, he was one of the most impressive two-year-olds. He was the heavy favorite for the Breeders' Cup Juvenile. It's obvious a throw-out race. But when you look at what he accomplished as a two-year-old, you know, it isn't like he won a grade one, even one grade one race. Maxfield's Breeders' Futurity, to me, was one of the most impressive races I saw a two-year-old run in 2019. It's a race that doesn't get much recognition, quite honestly, because it gets overshadowed by Independence Hall's fantastic race he ran in the Nashua and the Big Maiden win by Dennis's Moment at Ellis. So, but that race by Maxfield, to me, was, and I'm not convinced that he might not have won the Breeders' Cup if he'd had his chance to run in there. So, I mean, and we're only talking who I put third. It isn't like I put him first or second. So, and that two-year-old division this year, Steve, to me, you know, it was there for the winning for 'Tis the Law if he'd won the Kentucky Jockey Club at Churchill, and unfortunately he had a troubled trip that day, and he didn't win that race, but it was there for him to win. And, I put Storm the Court first because I think when you get down to it, and no one really, in the two-year-old male division, did anything put together a real campaign to where you'd say, yeah, that's who I'd vote for. You know, someone like a Game Winner in recent years, or to me, Storm the Court off the Breeders' Cup, he probably deserves it. So, but that division, to me, you could, Structor, I have no problem for anybody voting for Structor. He did nothing wrong, and he won a Breeders' Cup race. So You could throw him in the mix. So that was a wide open category this year. And as I say, it was ripe for the picking for Tisdalaw, and he just didn't win when he needed to win it, or he would have probably gotten it. I mean, I think that he would have been a cinch to get it if he'd won that Kentucky Jockey Club, but he didn't.
Fair enough. I'm not going to dive into a screed on George Strawbridge, but I don't get it at all. If he wins, I'll just shake my head. I mean,
no,
the Dolphin.
I had the Dolphin third too, and you made. You know what? See, when you rattle off all their stakes wins, that's a compelling argument right there. Kind of makes me wish maybe I'd talked to you before I'd done my ballot. So that was a category that I didn't have like the strongest opinions. So I could have been. That's a category I could have been more swayed. I think when I was going through this, and look, you know. People like an Andy Serling or whoever out there might disagree with some of my choices, but I'll guarantee it isn't because I'm not putting a ton of thought and research
sure.
into it myself. So, but that was a category I had kind of trouble with this year. And like I say, when you sat there and just rattled off all those stakes winners that Godolphin had, I think at one point during my process I had them first, and this could be a classic case where sometimes I overthink it and change my mind and should stick with my original thinking.
Well, that'll happen. I mean, I've done that too. When you start, you know, you start working on it in mid-December, and you know you don't make your choices until, you know, January 1. And you certainly like to wait for, you know, the last grade ones of the year and see if there's any, you know, impact. And there wasn't particularly this year. I mean, Omaha Beach is where he was going to be. I mean, he was the biggest player going into, you know, the last few days of the year when the grade one opportunities arose. But
And that Malibu did cause me to put, I originally was going to put Code of Honor second, but when Omaha Beach won that Malibu,
you moved him up
into second on my
interesting.
Ballot.
Interesting.
It wasn't like that race didn't have any consequence, but
nice. No,
to me, maximum security
good example.
Is an obvious, I mean, look, that Steve Askin wrote an absolutely beautiful Hanging with Haskin on, you know, when you look at maximum security, if he's not DQ'd in the Kentucky Derby, you know, and his only other loss where he didn't finish first was he stumbled at the start. I mean, this campaign, and it was what Haskin did was great, was bring up the point, what would have happened if he wins the Kentucky Derby, because he would have been in the Preakness, you know. I mean, they obviously would have gone for the Triple Crown. It would have changed his whole campaign there, and it's true. So, he certainly, you know, I remember being on your show at Santa Anita when we were sitting there at Clocker's Corner, and I was saying one of the points I wanted to make with you that morning after the Florida Derby was, I know people keep making a big deal that this horse ran for a claiming tag as a maiden, but there's nothing fluky about that Florida Derby to me. I know he won it wire to wire and he was on the front end, but this is a serious horse. And that's when you brought up the point that Bob Baffert felt that was the horse. You know, Baffert ended up saddling the favorite Improbable once Omaha Beach scratched. And that was the horse that Baffert felt was the horse to beat for the Kentucky Derby. And it turned out that he was the horse to beat because he finished first. But you know, that campaign that he had, you know, that Cigar Mile, that is certainly, that's a sparkling performance. I thought that was certainly one of the top performances by a three-year-old we saw all year, and he's beating older horses there. That's one thing about Maxim Security, beat older horses twice, and that certainly is a feather in his cap.
And, John, finally, I got to get Jeremy in here, what'd you do in older dirt mail? How did that Mattoli Vino shake out for you?
Well, it shows that even though when I'm a big fan of a horse, I don't really try not to let that affect my voting, because I don't think that's fair to the people that participate in the game. And look, I was a huge Vino Rosso fan. He's another one I wish was running this year, quite frankly. But I went with Mattoli. I thought that he, you know, that campaign that he had was outstanding. And You know, in addition to being male sprinter, I just see him as the older dirt male. That Matt Mile carries a lot of weight with me, but we're evaluating what happened on the American racing stage in 2019, because that field next to a breeder, any of the Breeders' Cup races, probably was the strongest field of the year, and Mattioli rose to the occasion at a distance that sort of like bricks and mortar rising to the occasion of the Breeders' Cup turf to go the mile and a half, which he'd never done before. And for him to win that and for Mattioli to go out to the mile and beat one of the strongest fields that we saw in a grade one race in the entire, for the entire year, and win it. I mean, the only thing that's an asterisk to me on the race is I think a case could be made that if McKenzie had had a different trip, he might well have won the race. So, but that's either here nor there. Mattioli won the race. That's what counts. And so for me, I did go for Mattioli, but boy, I certainly don't knock anyone who would vote for Vino Rosso at all, because he won the race. It's the championship race, and he won it with authority. And like I say, I just feel like if he'd had maybe one more win on the resume, when you can put his record up against Mattioli's, their body of work for the entire year, I thought Mattioli's body of work just swayed me more than Vino Rosso's.
No, that's fair, and it more or less. And as you know, we're just 2 days into these discussions, but it. In a lot of cases, it's just more the way you view the category, and if you do have predilection, and I do, for you know the route goers in this setting, and you know, and also knowing that Mattioli is going to win your sprint title, and I kind of like to you know spread the wealth and you know get as many. You know, many candidates that are worthy recognized as possible, and I think Mattioli is going to end up, you know, being a dual winner, but I think it's going to be close based on some of the things I'm seeing. John, let me move to Jeremy and get him in. We've got lots to cover with him as well, but we'll look forward to weekend three at Santa Anita, and we'll talk next week.
Very good, Steve. Great to talk with you, and Happy New Year.
And to you, and. We hope for the best in 2020, and let's continue on. No break, and Jeremy Plonk standing by a launch countdown to the crown on Friday, and I was speculating earlier, Jeremy, season, what did you say, season 12, 13, 14?